I'd like to welcome you to this seminar on Islam, and I think it is important that we state right at the beginning that it is not our intent, it is not our purpose, to offend the feelings of our Muslim neighbors and friends. As some of you recognize, the West has been witnessing a mass migration of Arab Muslims into Western countries as they come looking for an opportunity for better jobs and for education. And thus, today, as never before, we have the opportunity of ministering to Muslims who have come to us. Instead of, as born-again Christians, becoming missionaries and having to travel to Arab lands, let's say North Africa, we now have the situation where the Muslims are coming to us. You know, the Bible tells us in Jude 3 that we must defend the faith which was once and for all delivered unto the saints. Saint Peter also tells us that we should be prepared to give an answer when anyone questions us concerning the things that we hold near and dear in our hearts. It is out of this context that we're going to be dealing with the religion of Islam. We're going to be looking at it in terms of its nature, its origin. We're going to be looking at the life of Muhammad and how this compares to the life of Jesus Christ. Then we will be looking at the subject of the Quran and how it compares to the Bible. In dealing with Islam, we are going to be depending upon the scholarship that has been done for many years at such places as Oxford University, Cambridge University, Harvard, Yale, Columbia University, New York City University, the Cairo University, the University of Istanbul, by those professors, those men who have given their entire lives to the study of Arabic, to Persian, to Islamic studies. These men are the heads of their departments of Middle East studies, and we are going to be depending upon the scholarship that has been at work on the subject of the origin and nature of Islam from the very beginning. Of course, given the limited amount of time that we have, we cannot give you all the documentation. Matter of fact, it would end up quite boring if I simply stood up here and read to you all the citations and the books and the articles that could be quoted. You will find the documentation for all of the things that are stated in the seminar in the book, Islam, the True Desert Storm. The way that perhaps I think we ought to begin, and this is important for Westerners, is an attempt to understand the true or secret nature of the religion of Islam. Western people have great difficulties understanding the religion of Muhammad because they think in terms of the separation between church and state, and they think of that classic Western philosophic concept of the distinction between the secular and the sacred. Thus, in the West, what you believe and what I believe, these things are viewed as our private and our own personal beliefs, and that we do not feel in the West that differences of religious opinion should ever give cause to the destruction of the property or lives of other people. But you must understand that in dealing with the subject of Islam, we are not dealing simply with religious beliefs that are simply private opinion, but we are dealing with a culture. Perhaps the following illustration may be helpful. Imagine that we went out for lunch together, and as we were standing on a street corner, we're just minding our own business, this oddly dressed couple comes up, and you look at this guy, and you see, he has a powdered wig on his head, and he has this little short waistcoat, and there's a ruffled silk shirt, and he has these little breeches that go down to the knee, and you look, and you see, he has silk stockings and black shoes with silver buckles, and he looks like something that just stepped right out of a picture of 18th century America. The same thing in terms of the young lady that was with him. The woman was dressed with this very high wig, and she had a lovely dress that reached all the way down almost to the street itself. And you thought, well, this, what is this? You know, they just stepped out of a television show. Maybe this is America's funniest people or something of that nature. Candid Camera perhaps comes to mind. But they introduce themselves and they say that they are wanting to share with you their religion. And you said, well, sure, we've got a little bit of time. You can go ahead and tell me what your religion is. You know, we live in strange times, and there's a lot of strange religion. And the couple explained that they believed that George Washington was a mighty prophet of God, and that God had called him to create a religion that would be the final and great revelation of God's will to mankind. The writings, that is, the letters and speeches and materials that people have said traditionally that Washington wrote, you can go down to the library and look at the what are called the writings of Washington, and there's volume after volume, about 2 inches thick, and they explained that these books were actually written in heaven by God himself, and in the language of English, which is the eternal language of heaven itself, and that these books would be perfect English, grammatically perfect. There would be no foreign words. It would all be English. And these things actually were delivered out of heaven to George Washington. He didn't really write them, you say. They were brought down out of heaven so that all of those things which we call the works of George Washington, in reality, they were written by God in heaven on a stone table, and they were simply brought down in, to Washington, and he would simply recite, he would simply record what had already been done in heaven. And then it was explained to you that the way Washington lived, the way his wife dressed, what he would eat, what he would not eat. For example, he didn't like peas, so no one should eat peas today. That we must live as Washington lived. We must dress as he dressed. Our wives must dress like Mrs. Washington. And they're very serious about this. At that moment, their alarm went off on their little wristwatch, and he pulled out a compass, and he got in the right direction, and he got down and began to pray. And after they prayed for a while, they got up and dusted off their knees, and you said, well, what was this all about? And they said, oh, we have to pray 5 times a day toward the Washington Memorial in Washington, D.C. You say, you have to pray toward Washington, D.C. and the Washington Memorial? Oh, absolutely, or your prayers will not be accepted. And we have to make sure we're in the right direction and pray 5 times a day toward the Washington Memorial. And you say, well, why do you do that? Well, you see, the Washington Memorial was actually built by Adam, and it's been destroyed and rebuilt many times. And Abraham and all the patriarchs, you see, lived in Washington, D.C. area, and they rebuilt the Washington Memorial. And as a matter of fact, our religion says you've got to make a pilgrimage to Washington, D.C. to go to the Washington Memorial at least once in your life, and it's one of the pillars of our faith. And when you get there, you run around the Washington Memorial 7 times, and then you run on down to the end of the mall, and you throw some rocks at the devil. You say, well, you sure this isn't Candid Camera? I mean, is there someone here with the camera somewhere? This has got to be a joke. And the guy said, are you insulting my religion? You say, well, I'm not insulting, but this is obvious. You are taking 18th century American culture in terms of dress and things of that nature, and you're making a religion out of a culture. You don't really expect someone living in the end of the 20th century to eat and act and live. And the guy said, oh, yes. As a matter of fact, the political views of Washington are the laws of God. He believed in slavery. He had slaves. So slavery is also a valid political expression today as part of our religion. You say, hey, this is sort of obvious. I mean, what if the Russians invented a religion that you had to pray toward Moscow? What if the Japanese claimed that you had to have a pilgrimage to Tokyo? Why can't the Mexicans say you got to go to Mexico City? It doesn't make any sense. You've got to go to Washington, D.C., to the Washington Memorial, and run around it 7 times? And you claim Adam built that? Rebuilt by Abraham, the patriarch? I don't think the patriarchs lived in that territory. We know where Abraham lived. It was in Ur of the Chaldees, and he moved over, and it was in Palestine. I'm sorry. This is not right. Just then he opened up his coat, and it revealed he had a shoulder holster with a little gun in it. And he said, well, I wanted to show this to you because my religion also says that those who blaspheme Washington can be stopped. And we can force people to accept George Washington as the prophet of God and the writings of Washington as the writings of God. Just then your wish, Rich Ross, went off, and we said, hey, look, our lunch hour's over. If you want to talk about this some other time, I think it would be good, but we got to get back to the office. And we beat a hasty retreat, thankful we didn't have to deal with these people anymore. But you see, this modern parable is very important because it points out to us the true essence of Islam. In order to understand the nature of the religion of Islam, you must comprehend this fundamental fact. Muhammad took the culture, the customs, the religious rites, the things which he experienced in his own lifetime in 7th century Arabia, and turned all of those things into the religion of Islam. So that Islam is actually more cultural than it is religious. I remember one black Muslim family invited me to come to their home up in Harlem in New York City. And it was a wonderful opportunity to share Christ with them, but I went on up to their home, and when I stepped in that project, in that apartment, lo and behold, they had turned that apartment into something that you'd think came out of the Arabian Nights. Everybody was dressing like an Arab. We sat down and had Arab food. The guy even said an Arabic prayer over the food, though he admitted no one in his family understood any Arabic, yet they would recite things in Arabic. And you see, what did Islam mean for this American black family? It meant to leave American culture, the way we dress, the way we eat, the way we treat our wives, the way we deal with our kids, and to adopt instead Arab culture. Not modern Arab culture, but going back to 7th century Arabia to adopt the lifestyle that the Bedouin, the desert Arab, would experience back there in 7th century Arabia. And this is something that Western scholars have pointed out again and again. For example, Professor Arbery, who was head of Middle Eastern Studies at Cambridge University and the outstanding professor of Arabic and Persian. He wrote one of the best, if not the best, translations of the Quran in English, pointed out in his famous two-volume work on religion in the Middle East, and I quote, "Islam as a religion and a culture we recognize as fundamentally one," end quote. He states, therefore, that Islam, quote, is a peculiarly Arabian religion, end quote. This is something that is even noticed by Muslim scholars. Dr. Ali Dasti, he was a former prime minister of the country of Iran, a well-known scholar, poet, and newspaper publisher in the Middle East. In his book, 23 Years, A Study of the Prophetic Ministry or Career of Muhammad, he states unequivocally that in order to understand Islam, Western people must think in terms of culture rather than simple little beliefs. This is why it is incredibly difficult for Westerners to understand Islam. As Kerry Lovering pointed out, quote, "Islam is a total way of life, not just a religion." Or again, the Egyptian Victor Khalil quoted this statement, "Islam regulates every aspect of life to the point that culture, religion, and politics in a Muslim country are practically inseparable," end quote. To anyone who is familiar at all with Islamic culture, Islamic nation, there is a recognition that when Islam becomes the dominant religion in a nation, it alters the culture of that nation so that everyone is to eat, to dress, to treat their wife, to treat their children, to view crime, to view punishment, the entire political structure, everything that has to do with the life of that nation is altered over to Arab culture in terms of the 7th century. Now, in modern context, we call this cultural imperialism. Now, cultural imperialism simply means when one culture sets itself up as the absolute standard of all other cultures. Now, there's some Americans who have fallen into that, and if you're not American and you don't dress like an American, you know, you're pathetic, and that's wrong, and that's condemned in every university in the West. But you see, cultural imperialism also is a sword that deals with the subject of Islam. Just like that black Muslim couple, they were born in this country. But by the time Islam was through with them, the guy was wearing a cap and a long robe. His wife had a complete veil and a hood, and you could barely see the children, the way he raised her, what he could do. All of those things, the way they ate, everything there was in life had been regulated by the culture of Arabia of the 7th century variety. Some examples of this I think would be helpful, and even though in the book we go into multiple examples, I think one example would be very helpful at this point. Islam's relationship and treatment of women. We read in Dashti's book, again this is a Muslim scholar, quote, "In pre-Islamic Arab society, the women did not have the status of independent persons, but were considered to be the possessions of men. All sorts of inhuman treatment of women were permissible and customary." One example is found in the Quran itself, in Surah 4, which would be like saying chapter 4, but each surah is an individual revelation. In Surah 4 and verse 34, we read this: "Men are the managers of the affairs of women," or the custodians, says the Arabic. "Those you fear may be rebellious. You may admonish them. You may banish them to their couches, or you may scourge them," end quote. Dashti and other Muslims point out that Muhammad here gives the right of a husband not simply to beat his wife, but to scourge her. Thus, an Islamic country, if you're a woman and your husband beat you up and you went to court and you said, "My husband beat me up," you stand a good chance of being thrown into jail, because by your protesting and rebelling against the right of your husband to beat you, you are in defiance of the Holy Quran. Thus, I have read instances where one woman was in turn beaten by the court officials because she was in defiance of the Holy Quran. Now, in the West, we say immediately, what is this? You mean the Quran says that the husband has the right to beat the wife, to scourge her? Yes, that is exactly what it says. But even more to the point, Dashti again comments, quote, "The statement that men are the custodians or guardians of women in verse 38 of Surah 4 postulates inequality of men and women in civil rights. The words are followed by two brief explanations of men's superiority over women. In Islamic law, male heirs get more than female heirs, and men's evidence is more reliable than woman's. To be exact, a man's inheritance share is twice a woman's share, and his evidence carries twice the weight of a woman in court. The right to divorce belongs to the husband, but not to the wives," end quote. Now, take, for example, the dress that Muslim women are supposed to wear Now, does it matter if you're walking the streets of Los Angeles or you happen to be in New York City or London? You can be anywhere in the world, and you will know when you meet with a Muslim woman who is devout because of the way she is dressing. Now, you see, back in 7th century Arabia, some illiterate tribeswoman who lived in a tent, she was the possession of her husband, along with other women in a harem. In order to protect herself from the desert sun, she would be clothed from head to foot. She would not leave the tent without her husband's permission. There was no recognition of civil rights, human rights, or any kind of rights for women. She was the possession of her husband. Well, what has happened today? The same desert garb that Arab women were wearing long before Muhammad was ever born is now culturally imposed upon all women everywhere, regardless of the culture. In other words, the cultural dress of a 7th century Arabian woman has now been raised to become the divine law of Islam and of Allah. Do you recognize that in Islamic countries, women do not have civil rights? They cannot vote. Even in Kuwait, they cannot vote. They are not allowed by law to even drive a car in Saudi Arabia. In Iran, a woman may not be outside of the house unless she has written permission from her husband. When it comes to divorce, the man can divorce the woman, as it were, with the wave of a hand. If the woman goes to divorce the man, she loses her children. He gets the children under Islamic law. Some of you may have seen the movie Not Without My Daughter, and that movie is, in terms of historical and cultural accuracy, true to a T. Well, then, you see, when it comes to the subject of culture and religion, as we seek to understand what Islam is all about, we must immediately begin to think of not individual beliefs that we simply hold in our heart, but we must think in terms of 7th century Arabian culture that has been raised up to divine law, and then now this is sought to be imposed upon all other cultures. This is why Muslims claim that Arabic is the language of Allah in heaven. It's the language of heaven. They claim that it is the most wonderful language, the most beautiful language. And even if you don't understand it, you should recite your prayers and your benedictions over the food in Arabic. They even claim that the Quran cannot be translated into English or any other language because Arabic is the divine language and everyone should speak Arabic. Not only so, but in terms of the way people dressed, as we pointed out, the foods, what Muhammad would eat, what he would not eat, that all was determined by the culture and the times in which he lived. Or again, the political situation. During the days of Muhammad, the tribal life was regulated by the sheikh, the strong man, the dictator, the boss. The sheikh or the boss, the head of the tribe, had complete authority over the lives and property of everyone in that tribe. That's why out of 21 Arab nations, we do not have a single democracy. When you go and study the history of Arab nations, it does not matter if you're talking about Iran, Iraq, Yemen, Saudi Arabia, or you want to go in North Africa and you want to look at Libya with Gaddafi. Doesn't matter if you're talking about Saddam. You will always find that under Islamic law, those countries always have a dictatorship in which there is a boss man who runs the thing. And the laws, Islamic laws, are cruel and unusual. This is why some people were shocked during the late war with the Allies against Saddam Hussein, or Saddam, which simply means someone who's a shoe shine boy, instead of Sodom, which means glorious warrior. But in that recent war, the officials of Saudi Arabia announced that anyone who would protest against the war would either be executed or a leg or a hand cut off. And you see, under Islamic law, your ears could be cut off, your nose could be cut off, your tongue could be cut out, your eyes could be gouged out, your hands, your arms could be cut off, your feet, your legs could be cut off, and all of this is viewed as proper because in 7th century Arabia, this is how tribal vengeance was exacted. Matter of fact, we know that Muhammad himself on one occasion had two of his enemies brought before him. He ordered first that their eyes be punctured with thorns and that then that their hands be cut off, and then they were set free. When he conquered one Jewish settlement, he said and gave the command that over 800 men would be beheaded and the women and children sold into slavery. Thus, in this first lesson, the thing that we must understand is that we are not simply dealing with private religious beliefs that don't affect anyone. Islam is all of life. Islam seeks to regulate every aspect of life. It is 7th century Arabian culture that has been put forward into this century, and we are supposed to live as if we were in the 7th century. Unless this fundamental point is grasped at the very beginning, you will not understand the Muslim mind. You will not understand the Arab mentality. You will not understand the phenomena of Islam, the second greatest religion in the world. Julius Wellhausen, Theodore Noldecki, Joseph Howard, Edward Glasser, William Albright of Princeton University, Richard Bell of Yale, R. Berry of Cambridge, Montgomery Watt of the University of Edinburgh, and Alfred Guillaume and Arthur Jeffrey, and many, many other Western scholars simply ask this question. When you pick up the Quran never explains its terminology. It just says the word Mecca. It assumes that whoever reads the Quran is going to understand what Mecca is, what the Kaaba is, what is meant by pilgrimage, what is meant by jihad, the holy war. It's even an assumption that whoever would read this book would automatically understand the meaning of the name Allah, which is a name for a peculiar Arabian deity. You see, the Quran is based upon the assumption of the context of Arabian culture, customs, and religious rites. Thus, Western scholars have had to do a lot of work in terms of archaeology and literary analysis in order to understand the life and times of Muhammad. And when we did this, and it's over 100 years of research has gone into pre-Islamic studies, it was discovered that every single aspect of the religion of Islam can be fully explained in terms of pre-Muhammadan, pre-Islamic culture, custom, and religious rite. In other words, Muhammad really did not preach anything new to the people. He was a master at taking pre-existing materials and turning them into the religion of Islam. For example, the word Islam itself is not a word that was invented by the Quran. It is only found once and not even the proper form in the Quran. The word Islam in pre-Islamic times was a word that referred to courage and bravery as exhibited by that Bedouin tribesman when he went to war. For example, the Middle East scholar Dr. Bravman, in his book The Spiritual Backgrounds of Early Islam, had this to say, quote, "Islam is a secular concept denoting a sublime virtue in the eyes of the primitive Arab. It meant defiance of death, heroism, to die in battle, end quote. And when the word Islam originally was used in those early periods of the beginning of the religion, it meant someone who had chutzpah. He had courage. He had virility and strength. And he was not afraid to use the sword in defense of himself and his family. And even if he faced impossible odds, he would go to his death with courage. It is only later, as Dr. James Smith of Harvard points out, that the word Islam evolved slowly to mean submission to the will of Allah. But the word Islam itself is something that existed before Muhammad was ever born and had a history to it. Or again, we should notice the fact that in terms of Arab culture, killing your enemies, even in terms of a personal feud, was not something that was viewed as morally wrong. As a matter of fact, any criticism of one's religion or family was looked upon as complete grounds for killing someone. Again, Dr. William Montgomery Watt of Edinburgh University, who is recognized all over the world as one of the leading Islamic scholars, had this to say, quote, "It should be emphasized that the Arabs did not regard killing a person as in and of itself wrong. It was wrong if the person was a member of your kin group or an allied group. But in Islam, this meant the killing of a believer. Out of fear of retaliation, one did not kill a member of a strong tribe. In other cases, however, there was no reason for not killing," end quote. As a matter of fact, as we shall see, the Quran itself tells the followers of Allah that when they are confronted by unbelievers, they are to beleaguer them, to slay them, to kill them, to force them to submit to the will of Allah, and if they will not, the Quran says their just punishment is to be executed, to be crucified, or to have a hand or a leg cut off. You see, violence is one of the aspects of Islam that has been noted from the very beginning. Be it the Muslim armies that kept encroaching and conquering until, as many of you know, if Charlemagne at the Battle of Tours had not stopped them, then all of Europe would have been under the control of Islam. And even today, with the recent war that we've experienced, we know that Gaddafi and Saddam and others have proclaimed the jihad, or holy war, in which they sought the death of Western soldiers simply on the ground that these men would, by and large, be professing Christians. In the United States, we have the Black Muslim movement, which is noted for its violence. As a matter of fact, we even see that they assassinate each other, such as with Malcolm X and other leaders. And violence plays a significant role in Islam because it's part of the writings of Islam, because it was part of the culture that was in existence, which Islam absorbed into itself. Thus, what happened to Salman Rushdie with his book, The Satanic Verses, is a simple example in modern times of this mentality that if anyone disagrees with you, you have the perfect right to kill him. Now, with Salman Rushdie, his offense was one, was that he had left Islam. He had been raised a Muslim, and he, through his education, had been secularized to the point that he had fallen away. He had become apostate, and he did not believe in the religion of Islam anymore. You must understand this, and Western people have problem understanding this. That is a capital offense in Islamic countries. In Saudi Arabia, Afghanistan, Iran, if you are a Muslim and you convert to some other religion or to no religion, that carries the death penalty. One of my friends, in a joke, said it's like joining the mafia. It's easy to join, but it's hard to get out. And often the only way you can leave the mafia is in a pine box. Well, the same way when it comes with Islam, one of the great heartaches of Christian missionaries in Islamic lands is the knowledge that as they win this man or this woman or this young person to Jesus Christ, that this may cause their death. And documents and books, and this has been verified so many times, that the death sentence, the killing of someone, simply because he comes to accept Christ as his Savior, is an aspect of political law and of religious law, because the two are one in Islamic countries. Now, in terms of pre-Islamic Arabia, I think it is important to point out some of the things that are revealed. For example, I mentioned before, and I'll give you the citation now, in Surah 9 and verse 5, the Quran says, "Fight and slay the infidels wherever you find them, seize them, beleaguer them, lie in wait for them in every stratagem of war." Then in Surah 5 and verse 32, it says, "Their punishment is execution, crucifixion, or the cutting off of hands and feet from the opposite sides, or exile from the land." In terms of understanding the Mecca and the Arabia in which Muhammad was born, you must first of all recognize that Mecca was the great religious center of all the pagan worship that went on in Saudi Arabia. The Kaaba was a pagan temple. It was not built by Adam. The patriarchs did not live there. It was not rebuilt by Abraham. It was a place that had at least 360 idols. One of those idols was named Allah, as we shall see. And it was a place of pilgrimage where the pagans, whichever god they cared to worship, would come to the Kaaba in Mecca, and there they would run around the Kaaba seven times. They would run down to the Wadi Mida and throw stones at the devil. Various religious groups in Saudi Arabia, and this is all before Muhammad, prayed toward Mecca. They prayed toward Mecca because their god was stationed there. They had an idol of their god, and there was a niche they made in that stone building, and their god was sitting on a shelf, and it only made sense to them that if you're going to pray, pray in the direction of your god. And if your god is sitting over at Mecca, and it's part of the temple of the Kaaba, then what you do is pray toward Mecca. Pray toward the Kaaba. That's where your god is. Now you see, Westerners don't think that way. They say, well, you pray to God. God is everywhere. There's no direction we have to pray. We don't have to get out a compass to make sure our prayers get to God. But you must understand, to the pre-Islamic Arab mind, you prayed in the direction of where your god was stationed, and there were over 360 idols at Mecca. The Quraysh tribe, which was in control of Mecca, had as its financial base the religious pilgrimages that were made to the Kaaba. Now, they had what we would say in modern times, their hotels, their motels, their restaurants. And see, with thousands of people coming into Mecca to worship at the Kaaba, running around it, they'd kiss a black stone, and the black stone was a meteorite that had fallen out of the sky, and it was the good luck charm. All the Arab tribes had sacred stones and magic stones, and they would kiss that black stone, and they'd run around that Kaaba, and they'd do their religious rites and pray in that direction. All of these things were in existence before Muhammad was ever born. Matter of fact, from the literary and historical evidence, for example, in Chambers' Encyclopedia, we read this: the community in which Muhammad grew up was pagan, differing localities having their own gods, often represented by stones. In many places, there were sanctuaries to which pilgrimage was made. Mecca contained one of the most important, the Kaaba, in which was placed the black stone, long an object of worship. Or as the Encyclopedia Britannica points out, the financial base of the Quraysh tribe depended upon the caravans and the trade routes that would particularly go through Mecca in order for the pagans of all stripes to worship their particular idol at the Kaaba. You see, the Quraysh tribe was smart. if they were going to make Mecca the religious capital of Saudi Arabia, and all religions would have a reason for coming and thus spending their money on the motels and the meals, every time they heard about a new god, they'd put an idol up at the Kaaba, so that you had a veritable smorgasbord of deities, of Arabian deities, at the Kaaba. The lucrative trade was something that linked together the cultures and religions found in Africa, the Middle East, the East, and of course Europe and such places as Greece. In terms of pre-Islamic religious beliefs, the people, first of all, were basically superstitious. They believed in the problem of the evil eye, the casting of curses and spells. They believed in magic stones. They believed in fetishes. They believed in good luck charms. And they believed in the fabulous genie. Now, some of you remember the program, I Dream of Genie. Well, that's pretty close. The genies were the spirits, male and female, who inhabited trees and rocks and rivers and bottles and things of this nature. Some of you remember Aladdin's lamp, that if you rubbed out came the genie. And these genies would be parallel to Western superstitious beliefs in fairies, pixies, leprechauns, and things of that nature. And these genies, you see, could do all sorts of things, but they lived in rocks and in trees, and sometimes they were worshipped, and sometimes they were feared, and sometimes people even sacrificed to the genie. Most people have read stories from the Arabian Nights, and they have some familiarity with the idea of flying carpets and genies coming out of bottles and lamps. But it's no surprise to find that in the Quran itself, it refers to the fabulous genies and all of their remarkable powers. As a matter of fact, you even have in the Quran in such places as Surahs 55, 72, 113, 114, and elsewhere, whole discussions of the problem of the evil eye and of curses and how do you deal with this. Matter of fact, in most Muslim countries, Muslims will wear a necklace, and either it's a little bag with a paper scroll or it could be metal, and what it is, it has part of the Quran is written on either the metal or the paper, and this is worn around the neck in order to protect you from the evil eye. So that in terms of pre-Islamic Arabia, there was the belief in the necessity of wearing good luck charms and amulets to ward off the evil eye and the curses of other people. And you find all of this, as scholars have pointed out, in the Quran itself. Secondly, the population was by and large animistic. Now, animism is simply the belief that there is intelligences or spirits, good and bad, that inhabit the trees and things of this nature. This was, again, the basic pagan religion that was in Europe before Christianity came along. Some of you have heard the expression, knock on wood. Well, you see, when Christian missionaries particularly got to the Germanic tribe, the Germans believed that there were these spirits who lived in oak trees. And when you passed a tree, you should knock on the wood, as a good luck, to hope that that spirit would bless you. And you see, that little idea, even though the Christians ultimately showed there were no spirits in the trees, that the trees are good for making cabinets or chairs or tables or something. But animism is that basic pagan religion that still exists to a great degree in Africa and in South America and in Asia, particularly in third world countries. But the Arabs believed in these male and female jinns or spirits who existed in trees and stones and in the rivers and in things of that nature, and particularly the ones that existed in magic stones. These magic stones were the things which held a blessing for whoever possessed them. So Arab tribe would fight with Arab tribe trying to possess these magic stones. The greatest of the magical stones was a black meteor, according to the Encyclopedia Britannica, that was set up at the Kaaba, which people worshipped as some divine thing that fell out of heaven. It must be divine. It came out of the sky. The dominant religion at the time of Muhammad's birth in 570 was the Sabaean religion. The Sabaeans worshipped the hosts of heaven. Now, they were a little backward of many other cultures, that is, they reversed. In many cultures, the sun, because it was the brightest and the strongest, was the principle of male deity. And the moon, because it was less in glory and received its light from the sun, was viewed as the female goddess or deity. But the Sabaeans twisted that around and said the sun was the goddess and the moon was a male deity, and that these two beings produced as children all the planets and the starry hosts that we have seen in heaven. The Sabaeans thus were an astral religion. They worshipped the host of heaven. They followed a lunar calendar. They prayed toward Mecca. Muhammad chose the exact same five times that the Sabaeans had chosen to pray toward Mecca. The Sabaeans also, in following the lunar calendar, designated an entire month as a time of feasting and of fasting, which Muhammad then also absorbed. And these things, as pointed out by all reference work, it doesn't matter if you're dealing with the Encyclopedia of Islam, Dictionaries of Islam, or the Encyclopedia Britannica, any general or Islamic reference work will reveal this. Not only do we have to look at the Sabaeans, but also at the pagan rites. The pagans of pre-Islamic Arabia, as we have stated, worshipped and prayed toward Mecca, made a pilgrimage to Mecca. When they got there, they ran around the Kaaba, and they went down to the Wadi in order to throw stones at the devil. And this is something that is understood not only by Western scholars. This is based upon archaeology, upon literary sources that were in existence before Muhammad. Even modern Muslim scholars and Islamic scholars have admitted that this is exactly the case. For example, Arab scholar Nazar Ali points out, quote, "Islam retained many aspects of pagan religion," end quote. Alfred Guillaume, who was head of the Department of the Near and Middle East School of Oriental Studies and professor of Arabic at University of London and then later at Princeton University in New Jersey, had this to say, quote, "The customs of heathenism have left an indelible mark on Islam, notably in the rite of the pilgrimage," end quote. Professor Augustus Strong had this to say, quote, "Islam is heathenism in monotheistic form," end quote. Now, there was not only the influence of the pagans who were doing many of the things that we now understand to be Islam, but you also had foreign religions that existed in Arabia, because it was the main trade route over land. That you wanted to go from Africa and you wanted to trade your stuff, you'd have to go through Arabia. Or you were in India, or you were in Greece, you were in Turkey, and you wanted to come through and trade yourself with the Africans, the main trade routes went through Saudi Arabia. So that, as Muhammad grew up, and he talked with people who ran the caravans, he would meet individuals from all sorts of cultures and all sorts of religions. There were the Jews, who were there in great number, and many of their stories were well known. There were the Zoroastrians that came from Persia with all of their fabulous studies, stories. There were individuals from India, from China, from Greece, from Egypt. There are traces of Hinduism, Buddhism, Mithraism, Greek mystery religions, the Egyptian religion. All of these things were quite well known before the time Muhammad was even born. And you might as well as throw into the fact that the Christians had established themselves in southern Arabia, and they were flourishing. The only problem is they were predominantly uneducated, and they were heretical in their beliefs concerning the Trinity and the nature of Christ and the relationship of Mary to God. So you had all of these different religions, and as these people in the caravans would sit around the fire and swap stories, their favorite fables and stories, you could have a Hindu, you could have a someone who was a Zoroastrian and a Christian and a Jew and a pagan. And all of these stories, of course, were known in the community. They were written about. We know it. We found it. The inscriptions are there. The idols are there. We know all about it. And this is what the Germans would call the Zitzenleben. This is the context, the framing, the framework around Muhammad that molded him in terms of his thinking and his beliefs that led him to the religion of Islam. Without this understanding of pre-Islamic Arabia, no true understanding of Islam is possible.